From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There are a few of you out there who don't get the whole Star Wars obsession. But to your credit, you're going to good-naturedly abide the weeks of hype as the new Star Wars film, The Force Awakens, opens at midnight. It's just a movie, right? Well, right. But the film historian Darrell Larson says for those who were swept up by Star Wars when it first opened in 1977, the series is like scripture. It's canon. There's a reverence, a devotion to the story. And so, along with the excitement, there's some anxiety about whether director J.J. Abrams will get this one right. Whatever that means. If you're a fan, you know. Today in the program, we're talking about Star Wars. And the biggest question may be, why was it, is it, such a big deal? Join us after the news.
Hey, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard. I'm one of the producers of Radio West. If you like what you hear on the show, you can lend a hand by giving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or Facebook. And we'd also really appreciate it if you'd share what you think about the show, or if you have some thoughts about a particular episode, share that stuff around on whatever social media platforms you happen to use. Thanks a bunch and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking Star Wars. The latest film is opening at midnight. This version is called The Force Awakens, directed by J.J. Abrams. But of course, you know all of that because it's everywhere and because you can't wait to see it, or most of you can't. And that gets us to one of the questions that interested us. What is it about this film series that has so excited so many people? For a lot of us, we can trace it backwards, like way back to 1977 when we first saw that first film. I first saw it at the Center Theater in Salt Lake. I think it was on Broadway. A friend had won tickets on a radio station. And maybe a lot of affection for Star Wars had as much to do with the time, that experience, as anything else. But then, of course, there's the story itself. This is classic myth-making. This is a hero journey. And that's one of the reasons people love it. Darrell Larson is back with us. He's a professor of theater and media arts and the Center for Animation at Brigham Young University. His 1993 master's thesis was titled Raider of the Lost Art, George Lucas and the Autorism in THX 1138, which was his first film. Oh, and American Graffiti and Star Wars. Sorry, there's a lot there in that title.
There
it's a typical
there.
Thesis title, isn't it?
It is.
His most recent book is about the film Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And, of course, we had him on not so long ago to talk about that. Darrell Larson, welcome back to you.
Thank you very much.
Lee George Cade is with us, a panelist on the Geek Show podcast, and a big fan of this show, of the Star Wars series. Welcome to you. Thanks for joining
Happy to be here, Doug. Thank you.
Well, can we start with first experiences? You remember your first? You?
Absolutely. Professor? 1977 at the Festival Cinema in Fresno, California. My mom took all of us. And I think he actually came to Fresno in June, not in May. A little bit later than other places.
Really?
But still, that first Saturday was fairly quiet. We didn't have a full house, though we tried to go back to the movies the next Saturday and couldn't get in.
Yeah.
So it, took off very quickly. But I simply remember it being absolutely magical, one of those defining kinds of films. I was 13, so it was the perfect age, perfect film. So we met quite well at that point.
Now, Lee, you're younger than us, I'm guessing.
Just a smidge.
So when did you – how old
I was
you?
Seven
yeah, yeah,
in 1977. And I saw Star Wars at the legendary Pickwick Drive-In Theater in Southern California. I did not want to see Star Wars. Huh. I was dragged kicking and screaming. I wanted to see The Rescuers, which came out that same period of time. And I thought, man, we're in line to see The Rescuers. This is so great. And my dad decided we were going to see Star Wars instead, and he's been paying for that ever since.
Okay, so Larson says it's magical. Darrell Larson says he was kind of mad. For you, when did it kick in?
I was as a little kid, I was a Star Trek fan. I loved Star Trek. But yeah. Star Trek, you know, 1966 to 1969 television technology, yeah. It's not really going to take you there so much as you can take yourself there. I think Star Wars was the first time I remember being completely taken out of my own reality and put into another. So that Tantive IV flying across the screen and the Star Destroyer sucking it in with the tractor beam, and that was it. I was done. I was completely done. And 2 hours later, I just want to get right back in line and go back. So, and seriously, I mean, to this day, I'm so excited. I'm seeing it tonight, the new movie, 7 o'clock. My only regret is that I can't drag my dad kicking and screaming to see it. So my kids will have to, you know, be the surrogate.
Yeah. So was it – one of the things you've talked about, Darlison, is context. Like this was – so I'm trying to figure out – okay, so for Lee, it was like taking you to another world. I get that. That makes a lot of sense. Probably something to do with the technology and all of that, right? But I'm wondering if it was also part of our affection for it as we think back on Star Wars had to do with just – the experience itself, like not necessarily the film, the quality of the film, the story. There is that. I mean, that's the reason we got hooked in the first place. But a lot of our it's like Catcher in the Rye. Like, you know, you read the Catcher in the Rye when you're an adolescent, when it means the most. And then you go back and it doesn't have the same quite the same kind of feeling. Is that part of what it was for Star Wars for people? Was that experience? Was the context of the time?
It may be, and maybe what hasn't changed perhaps is, unlike other films and or texts that we drink in, it may not have changed. In fact, it may have enriched over times. Nostalgia is certainly essential. The film doesn't exist without nostalgia, right? It's George Lucas putting together bits and pieces from his filmic past, you know, whether it's, you know, Metropolis or a Hidden Fortress from Kurosawa, the Flash Gordon Buck Rogers series, very, very, you know, those serials that he would have seen every Saturday, and my dad remembers seeing, and just desperately couldn't wait to go back that next Saturday to see the next installment, see what Ming the Merciless was going to do this week, and how, you know, the good people would escape. So nostalgia, I think, is essential, but it's a film that's held up over time.
Yeah.
And in even though it's the newest of technologies at that time, and it's not a computer generated film, and it's not even necessarily a computer assisted film, you can look at it and say this is an old school film that used purposely old school technology, right, with the VistaVision camera work and that sort of thing, which we're sort of going back to right now, interestingly, right? Tarantino's latest film is gloriously in 70 millimeter. Yeah.
Totally rejecting digital.
That idea that we're moving away from that. Christopher Nolan's in that same boat.
Yep.
So nostalgia important. We've gone back to this film. I think that's a big part of it. And as I read the critics' reviews of this film, what's interesting is if there's a complaint, the complaint is that it's too much like this 1977 original film. Which is probably a criticism that J.J. Abrams is perfectly willing to accept.
I think that's right. The context of the time, one thing you've pointed out, Darl Larson, this was a couple of years after Watergate.
Yeah.
The fall of Saigon wasn't that far past.
Yep.
There was an energy crisis. We're sort of in that. Wasn't this right around the time when Carter was talking about the malaise?
The malaise, that word, which he's never been able to escape
yeah,
since.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's fairly dark times, and it's interesting to look at the science fiction from that period and realize that a film just about a year earlier, which was Logan's Run, big budget, exciting kind of film, but a much darker film. And once you get to the end of that film and they escape the world – sorry if I'm giving anything away for viewers of a 1976 film. But when they get out, there's this big question mark. There's destruction that they're met with, and it's not a happy ending. And so in 1977, when George sets out to make his version of all these films together, I think he goes from the very beginning that it is going to be a film that has a happy ending, that it celebrates an accomplishment over the biggest odds you could imagine. And, you know, of course, with that culminative moment of the Death Star exploding, it doesn't get bigger than that.
It's true.
Since then, it's become sort of the it's a part of our lexicon, that idea of the ultimate event is, you know, blowing up that Death Star, meaning we've accomplished. So I think the positiveness of the film, the happy ending of that film is as important as anything else, as a technology, as the way it was written, as the way it's been received, is that it was a happy film.
Oh. Does that surprise any of you? I mean, if you think about, he had dystopian idea, THX 1138. Super dystopian.
Very.
And dark. So it seems surprising that he would create a film that had such a triumphant end.
Well, we need our fairy tales.
Yeah.
We desperately need our fairy tales. And I think that's where Star Wars ended up striking that chord with so many people is we've become so jaded as our Leave It to Beaver era faded off. And we start realizing that our government is complicit in so many terrible things. And that's kind of what seems like Watergate and Vietnam and all of those things came together. And we looked at that and said, oh, this is we're not this happy, shiny place that we thought we were in. So getting our fairy tale right when we needed it, I think it was such a may have been a placebo overall, but we watched this, we absorbed it, and I know so many people have written about it before that it tied into so many of those thematic, universal, mythological tropes that every culture's had. So not just here, but in Russia, you know, at the time, our biggest enemy, they were probably sitting down watching Star Wars and going, I needed this mythology, I needed this fairy tale,
yeah. I want to come back to the mythology thing because I think that's really interesting. It raises the question, too, about is this a great piece of filmmaking? Like, is Lucas a great director? Or did he just, with this one thing, kind of luck out on some level or get the – you know what I'm saying?
I do.
What do you think?
I think – I'm gonna go ahead and say that – you know, great's a hard word, but he is a very gifted filmmaker. His, you know, the thesis I wrote was on the three films that he directed to that point, and then he essentially retired from directing. Yeah. Star Wars was sort of the straw that broke his camel's back. Very, very challenging film. But if you watch those films, you realize that he has a very gifted cinematographer's eye of movement. He's a natural editor. If there's challenges, it's perhaps that he can be on the set, I've heard, withdrawn and quiet. Mm-hmm. And so working directly with actors was always a challenge. And so it required that actors worked on their own or with each other. But other than that, what we see are three films, very different films that he created. The first, a critical success, but of course not a commercial success. It's a darker dystopian tale. But American Graffiti for many years was the most successful, financially successful film ever created based on how much it cost to create the film. Huh. It held that record for quite a few years. And it's also a very, very fun film, but also has that edge of darkness, of questioning what's happening tomorrow,
yeah.
Of adolescence growing into adulthood and all the challenges that go along with that. That culminated really – I mean, if he'd stopped making films in a sort of F.W. Murnau kind of way, who passed away in 1941 far too early after making films like Sunrise, if George had stopped making films, I think those three would have set him – you know, would have put him in the canon of great – in the pantheon of great filmmakers, and he would have stayed there. And maybe that's what he wanted in 1978, 79, and 80, and then as the other films came on. The challenge to go back to making films, to go back to the Star Wars universe was probably something he couldn't say no to eventually. And there, of course, the films, as we'll probably talk about, a little less successful for various reasons. And there we begin to ask questions about great filmmaker versus filmmaker that might be hidebound by the expectations, or at least the way he saw the expectations of an audience or of the world that he'd already created.
Yeah.
But I think the three films that he did create culminated in a terrific film that we are talking about today, Star Wars.
What do you think?
I think you get to kind of a fundamental difference between a person who's an ideator and very strongly driven by the process and the development and the excitement of new technology. And if you watch, for instance, The Phantom Menace, that movie is more a sizzle reel for motion capture than it is for the prowess of acting, even though there are people like Ewan McGregor, he's a fantastic actor. He's going to show up and act. He's going to do it very well. But I don't think Lucas, at the end of the day, is going to be able to draw out a phenomenal performance from an actor who needs direction because he's too busy thinking about motion capture. He's thinking about how are we going to green screen Coruscant because I have this idea of this Art Nouveau planet that is entirely a city because, you know, each planet has its own ecosphere and this one's a city ecosphere. That's all he's thinking about. He's not thinking about getting Natalie Portman to give this phenomenal performance. Even though she's a great actress, she might need more direction than, say, a Terrence Stamp or Ewan McGregor. So ultimately, I think at the end, his shortcoming is that maybe he's just too caught up in the technological prowess. Or I remember my great uncle, he's a rocket scientist. my conversations with him make about as much sense as some of the plot elements in Phantom Menace.
Right.
Because he is so much smarter than I am. I'm a fairly smart guy. He is so much smarter than I am that sometimes I feel like he's just talking to the toddlers in the room. And I think sometimes that's kind of what we're getting, that we're seeing a huge brain at work. And it's not all necessarily translating to us as well as it could.
It seems not the greatest writer of dialogue, as I've always thought. He had to have help, I guess, to sort of punch up the script.
Carrie Fisher ghost wrote quite a bit of the dialogue in the prequel movies. So,
is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, not the great, but I guess because he had the vision. I mean, and I guess in some ways, whether he could really direct Alec Guinness or not, he had the vision for the story, and that was really the starting point anyway. That was the thing that mattered, at least initially, you think?
Oh, sure.
Absolutely. The world doesn't exist, right, without George Lucas. And yes, as he worked on the first three Star Wars films, he worked with, eventually, good writers on all of those. He teamed up with writers to help him, particularly with dialogue on all three of those films. And it paid off in spades, because some of the great moments, you know, the interactions between the Carrie Fisher and Harrison Ford and those kinds of things came after the fact, because they had nothing to do with the technology. They had nothing to do with the Mace Windus of the world and those kinds of things. Mm. That had to do with two actors who had some chemistry talking to each other on the set. And if you remember, some of those lines begin to sound like we're listening to some screwball comedy moments from the late 1930s.
Yeah, here's Spencer and
absolutely.
Yeah,
some very
Hawks.
Terrific, yeah. Terrific moments. So at that point in those three films, George was very willing to accept help. I think one of the challenges in the later three films in the prequels is that George is the credited writer.
Yep.
That's it, start to finish. And not being able to ask for help, not being willing to ask for help, or perhaps not knowing that you should ask for help is a challenge when it comes to worlds that are these large with films that are these demanding.
Well, you've talked about that those early films, certainly the first one. I guess those first three were all about collaboration. I mean, he was working with people and willing to collaborate. The prequels.
Well, he had to,
so
right? He had to collaborate.
Yeah.
That first film, Universal said no, right? Ned Tanen at Universal said, "I don't get this at all, and thank you for coming." Sorry, Ned and family. But that then they went to Fox, and Alan Ladd Jr. said, "Okay, but you know, whatever George brought with him, maybe a 12-page
notebook,
of silly, crazy Starkiller Windu, these kinds of things, he brought to him. He saw something there." And he also saw – this is 1976, and Jaws had just broken every record there was. And so he was also – Spielberg was this young guy. So here was this guy sitting in front of him, George Lucas, who also went to film school and also seemed to have something going for him, and done American Graffiti, which was huge.
Yep.
So it wasn't a surprise that got greenlit. It was only $8.5 million that he was given initially, which if you think today, you don't go for Starbucks
crazy.
Down there
that's,
for
that's,
$8.5
that's less than they paid Nicholson for Batman.
Absolutely. He still makes more than that on Batman. So, and then he eventually got another $1.5 million to finish the film. But Star Wars really was a $12 million film that, of course, has paid off into the billions. He had to cooperate. He had to have people around him who could do stuff that he couldn't do. He had to be able to bring people in who he could describe, this is the kind of camera movement I want. And then he had to have someone actually build those cameras and the motion control kind of stuff. That's where computers helped. But build those kinds of bits of equipment in Van Nuys, right, in a parking lot there so they could shoot Death Star sequences.
If only I'd known what they were filming six blocks from my house.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Was it nearby?
I lived in Van Nuys. When
nobody knew.
Right.
Nobody cared.
Nobody cared, yeah. So I'm trying to see a bunch of guys with model kits and a camera.
Do we have a sense of what it was like on the set in 76 or whenever it was, what they were doing? I mean, you had Peter Cushing and Alec Guinness. You had some extraordinary actors. You had a kind of a crappy actor at the time, Mark Hamill. It wasn't great.
He hadn't learned yet.
He was young.
Right? I mean, he had figured it out eventually. I don't know if anyone knew much Carrie Fisher. No one really knew.
Carrie Fisher had been what? She'd been in Shampoo. She was known for being a famous daughter. She's moved well beyond that, of course.
And Harrison Ford had graffiti, and he had been a carpenter before
good.
That.
Right,
he was a studio carpenter.
Yeah.
He worked odd jobs around the sets and stuff.
So what were they saying to each other? Like, what kind of stupid thing are we involved in? Do we know?
Absolutely. They've talked about it a number of times. the dialogue was something they have to work. And since they were often not given a lot of context from the director, they were left talking amongst themselves. How do I say this line? What is a Nerf herder? How do I when I'm talking about a Death Star exploding or going into hyperspace or et cetera, all these things were being done on the cheap and with very little help from the outside. So I think the actors actually probably, you know, built their own little union there and worked together actually pretty well. Guinness talks about feeling completely lost on the set and reading the paper and at night telling his wife, I have no clue what's going on in this production. And she's saying, well, just keep going.
And
the paycheck was significant.
It's better than a framing bill.
It was probably a hectic set. And it was very different from – they were shooting most of it in London. I mean in England at the studios there, and everything shut down at a particular time. And there was no such thing as overtime, and a very different kind of world. But probably all those things demanded that, you know, like the finest wine grapes have to have sometimes the worst soil. This film probably needed all those things in order for it to really coalesce into what it became.
I think the one guy that probably didn't have any trouble was Cushing. I mean, with 20-some-odd years of Hammer horror movies and pretty much, okay, we built this set for $28 and you're going to stand here and look menacing for a few minutes, and then Christopher Lee's going to run in and look menacing, and then at some point someone's going to run in with not a lot of clothing on, and you're going to say something that sounds stupid, but it'll be great and atmospheric, right. And then you'll kill Dracula, and that'll be it. So I imagine for him it was pretty much just another paying gig.
Let me read a few things that were Cameron writes from Murray. It seems to me like the critical what was critical was the design of the world, the technology, the spacecraft, the characters were essential to Star Wars' success. It just all looks really cool, especially to a kid, cooler than something that started out more low budget like Star Trek, which has great characters but suffers visually compared to Star Wars. Seems to align with what you were saying there earlier, Lee. We got a comment from Susan in Park City who says, Princess Leia was one of the first characters that a little girl in the 70s could relate to. She's right there with the good guys fighting the bad guys.
Absolutely.
That jumped out at me just rewatching the original trilogy here in this last week. In episode 4, she's really the only one that knows what's going on. I mean, they come and rescue her. They blow up the control station. They have no idea how to get where they're going. They're putting together ideas on the fly, and she's the one that knows how to get through with the trash compactor. She's actually the military genius of that Trinity. She's got Abbott and Costello rescue her, and she's kind of the brains behind the operation.
It's true.
And they've done a really good job recently with Marvel Comics has been doing some great behind the scenes stories, and they did a 4 or 5 issue Princess Leia story that actually shows her upbringing on Alderaan and how she was trained to be a warrior and a diplomat. So it's pretty neat to see how that background.
I like that because you could tell she could change her own oil, right?
Yeah,
you know what
definitely.
I mean. Which was, I don't know if it was so novel in 1977.
It was fairly novel for that period. Of course, it's a borrow. If you've seen Hidden Fortress, you realize that the princess in Hidden Fortress is this princess who's very much in control. In fact, the picture of her they use is her hands on her hips with her feet spread. And she's just got that look of, I'm in charge. Everybody listen to what I'm – and she is in charge. She does what she's supposed to do. That's a significant film for Lucas. But yeah, mid-1970s. We are not seeing an awful lot of
strong
female leads. I already mentioned 1976's Logan's Run, and you realize that Jenny Agutter in that film is introduced as a sort of prostitute character, and it doesn't take very long to make sure that before she gets her clothes off
at
some point in the PG-rated film.
Yeah. I know!
Which was the whitest ratings we ever had.
That's why we all went.
8-lane freeway, yeah.
Well, you look even at Soylent Green, which was a few years before that,
yep.
And the prominent female lead was being referred to as furniture.
Right.
And so we didn't kind of have those strong in-charge female characters. I know Gloria Steinem definitely wanted them, and they were using Wonder Woman as a kind of a poster woman for change in the 70s. So I think Leia might have been a big thing. I know my little sister, I was 7, she was 5, and man, she couldn't stop talking about how cool Princess Leia was because for once, it wasn't that she could be the love interest. She could have a blaster rifle and have fun too, so...
Here's this from Keith who writes, when my wife and I were engaged, we went to Star Wars and have subsequently seen it for our anniversary with every new release.
Nice.
Lee George Cade is with us, a panelist on the Geek Show podcast. We'll put a link to that on our website. Dara Larson back with us, professor of theater and media arts at BYU. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about Star Wars. In case you haven't heard, the new one is opening. What time today? Is it? Did you say 7?
My showing's at 7 tonight. Oh. So, and I know there's a bunch of people at the Valley Fair Mall right now that have been watching Star Wars since midnight, and their showing I think is roughly that time as well.
That's Lee George Cade, who's with us. Darrell Larson also with us. So I wanted to just get a sense of where you figured George Lucas was coming from. 1962, Darrell, you've written about this. He's 18 years old. And he gets in a very, very bad car accident.
Right.
And he's laid up. What do we know about that time? This gave him a time, obviously, to think about his life and to sort of reform.
Sure.
He was sort of a screw up, I think, in some ways. What effect did this have on the way he started to think about the story?
I guess we could call it sort of psychobiography idea. But yeah, he is injured. He loves cars. American Graffiti is George.
Autobiography.
Yeah. He grows up in Modesto, California, which is north of Fresno, not too far from. So we're in sort of the same communities. It's a fascinating time because it's at a time where if you're not in school, then you may find yourself in the military. Vietnam is hotting up overseas. Questions are asked. Decisions have to be made. What are you going to do with your life?
Yeah.
So if you go to university, then you've chosen what you're going to do. He decides to study film, but this is after reading all the things that really begin to inform the Star Wars, you know, the mythological things.
Joseph Campbell.
The Campbell world, Herbert's Dune series, which if you've watched the Star Wars world, you realize is without which it doesn't exist.
Where to get the idea of a desert planet.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
right. That's right. And Asimov, of course, his Foundation series is very critical because we have, you know, Coruscant starts there. But he does a lot of reading and he prepares himself for the rest of his life. Then he heads off to school and decides to do film school and is going to be an editor / cinematographer. Don't think he wanted to be a director initially. But it's important because he loads himself up first before he heads off to school. Yeah. Loads himself up with the reading
and does his
survey
ideas.
Of literature, if you
yeah.
will. And then reaches school and says, all right, well, what do I do? Throws it wide open. This is the time when really for the first time cinema studies is a part of the curriculum at these major universities. You're looking at these international films. He's being introduced to the French New Wave filmmakers who are, of course, very, very influential to his eye specifically and the way he wants to operate the camera. So it's kind of a remarkable period. And it does sort of go back to that moment where he's injured and laying around and asking, what do I do tomorrow? And it's interesting in looking at all his films, you realize that he demands each and every one of his character or set of characters to do precisely that same thing. THX
reflect.
THX has to lose his spouse before he can escape from that world or at least try to escape from the world. The boys and girl in American Graffiti must make up their minds. They must change. They must have some sort of loss before they transition away from their small town. And of course, Luke, as we talk about in my screenwriting classes, Luke's aunt and uncle must die. It sounds terrible, but he's staying on that planet unless they are gone. And he, as he says later, there's nothing for me here now. Yeah. I've got to leave. And he does. And he heads off on his journey. And that's that classical journey to go out and find what's going to be good for his community. And of course, he eventually does make that full return. It'll be interesting to see how this latest film, series of films, builds on that since we are staying with that Luke character. That's actually kind of fascinating to me.
And his entire life, too.
Exactly.
Think about it, you know, from very early on to what is it, now Hamill's in his mid-60s.
Yeah, we don't get that very often actors or characters.
But I wonder, did you think George Lucas intended when he first laid out this story, this is Luke's story? Or this is Anakin's story. I mean, there are these principal characters. Did he lay that out originally and think, okay, that's this universe that I'm going to deal with? Or did he think, this is one part, then we'll find some other parts? Do we know?
I think trying to figure out what Lucas had initially intended is kind of like talking to Obi-Wan Kenobi. I mean, it's there's a lot of half-truths in there.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
He has famously said that even though there are script pages showing that Greedo shot first, he has said several times, no, that was never the intention. I didn't shoot it right. I wasn't quite as elegant as a cinematographer.
Right.
You're watching Star Wars and saying, you didn't shoot that right? Every single angle in that movie is plotted out to the nth degree. So he changes his own inner narrative so many times on the way he wanted to do things. But he is following the classic hero cycle. I do think ultimately the original six movies were the narrative of Anakin Skywalker in very many ways. I mean, it kind of follows the Mabinogion, the old Celtic fairy tale of the Mabinogion. It, mm-hmm. it follows that very, very closely. Mm-hmm. Even down to having to have your son come and redeem you. You know, it's all in there. So I'm sure those elements were there. And that he wanted to follow off of those. Where he wanted to go with the last three movies, because that's another one where he's changed the narrative at. He's always said there were nine movies, but then after Jedi, I think he was so burned out, he said, no, there's just six. It was six. I promise.
Yeah, even after Star Wars, he was reconsidering what he was going to do with the world. But it was so successful, there was no going back. A second film was going to happen, right? So Empire Strikes Back was essential. I've even heard that there was a tenth culminating film at some point. But again, that's all in this sort of jumble of handwritten pages that is an entire universe which covers everything we've seen so far plus the stuff we haven't seen yet. So that's what he was thinking when he started all this, which you can understand why some studio heads would have said, I don't get this at all. I don't understand it. He chose Luke probably as the guy that's most representative of himself, I suppose. So start the film there and start the narrative there. Maybe get back to telling the older stories at some point. But we have a film with Luke that takes us from humble beginnings to Death Star explosion. That's a film. That's got a beginning, middle, and end.
I think he also looked at it and said, well, you know, this is a technology we can shoot, because he knew he had his grand Art Deco world. You know, your decline of the old Republic is actually really depressing if you think about it. It's society at its greatest. It's New York in the 20s. It's beautiful glitz and glamour everywhere. Mm-hmm. And so, but you can't film that with 1976 technology. It's just not going to work. It's going to look pretty hokey. Or maybe you'll pull a Fritz Lang and do something amazing. But at the end of the day, he's looking at Tatooine saying, okay, well, we can do Tunisia. That's easy enough. Desert planet. We can pull that off. And we can build sets in Elstree, and that'll work too. So we can do that. That's something that I think he was cognizant enough to sit down and say, this is definitely within our limits right now.
Sure. And during the shoot, he realized that even characters like Jabba, who was supposed to be in this first film, and the outtakes are still there of the actor who's portraying
him. In his big furry suit.
Yeah, with his very nice Scottish accent. But he realized, George, they tried stuff. They tried to build stuff. They tried to create motion capture stuff. Early motion capture. They tried to do modeling, you know, frame by frame work. None of it ever looked good. So that part got removed from the film. So it's a good point. He probably started also where he thought he could finish properly, and that was this part of the tale.
Well, if you can't see the end of it, don't start.
Exactly. Lee, I wanted to ask you about the Force.
Mm.
You've talked about how, in some ways, Lucas kind of just strips out the brand names of spirituality and religion.
Mm.
But these were things that he was – I guess my question is this a belief in the supernatural? Is this his sense of God, of the cosmology of the universe? Do we know?
Well, it's a very kind of a funny post-New Age, pre-New Age, during the New Age that Lucas is writing all of this, where New Age thought is kind of pervading everything. The Force is a very easy way for Lucas to write a story that will appeal to a Shinto Buddhist, that will appeal to somebody who's following Judaic philosophy, somebody who's Christian. They can look at it and say, okay, well, God is something that permeates all of us. God is something that is around us and through us, and through our connection with this being, with this Force, we can perhaps manipulate things. But where Lucas is really canny about it is that the Force is not good or bad. The Force is just the Force. So we say there's a dark side, there's a light side. There's this great undertow, undercurrent through the entirety of all these Star Wars movies where the Force is out of balance and the Jedi in their arrogance think that their chosen one is going to come and bring balance to the Force, not realizing the only way to do that is to destroy the Jedi Order. There's too many of them. There's not enough balance. So you have to have this perfect balance between the light and the dark. So then you get into Eastern philosophy with your balance of the of not good and bad, but of dark and light, those contrasts that we kind of have to walk that perilous line. So is it spirituality or is it just kind of a way of saying it's a lot easier to look at life and morality, and do you need religion to be a moral person, or do you just need compassion and empathy and maybe a code of ethics? And that's kind of where I think he's ultimately going, that it's a bigger picture than we're necessarily capable of understanding because we have our own prejudices from our own upbringing and our own culture and our own backgrounds. But it's a very simple and elegant way to explain space spirituality.
Yeah. Does that help us understand why it was so damn popular in the beginning? We're connecting to these things that are deeply embedded in us?
I think that's certainly part of it. It also sets it apart from most other films being produced at that period. You know, if we remember it as the me decade, if anything, spirituality or even any version of spirituality is pushed far off to the side as possible. So we see these films that are embracing things of the world, if you will, and things of the mind and things that man can create and control unapologetically. And sometimes critics bashed him for this and continue to do so. Lucas embraced a form of spirituality in his film that was about the cosmos and about technology and about the future and the past, as it turned out, and said it's okay. There are controlling entities around us. We can acknowledge those and celebrate them. So I think it spoke to virtually every audience.
Yeah,
very, very hard to do.
It's funny. You're not going to get people from different branches and walks of life and religion that can sit down and talk about your Abrahamic religions that are going to sit down and say, well, even though we all follow the Old Testament, we follow this, we have these fundamental differences. But I bet you I could get three people from three separate Abrahamic faiths to sit down and talk about Star Wars.
Yeah. Talk about Yoda.
And get really excited.
Yeah.
And maybe find a lot of common ground there.
Let's take a call. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Suzanne is with us in Salt Lake. Suzanne, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to say that I first saw it in 78, of course, as an adult. And I've been to the opening night of all of the other Star Wars. And tonight I'm taking 17 of my children and grandchildren to the opening. And as I mentioned, I adopted a lot of kids with lots of problems, and they've, you know, prison, jail, addictions, you name it. But one thing we all have in common is Star Wars. We're all Star Wars fans, and I feel like a very successful mother because of that.
That's great.
Congratulations.
Yeah, congratulations. Suzanne, thanks for the call. Back to the phone. Michael in Birmingham, Alabama. Michael, hi.
How you doing? Lee, Geek Show says hey.
Hey, Geek Show.
And the reason why, as I was telling the screener, the reason why the Star Wars movies mean a lot to me, when I was 13, that's when Return of the Jedi came out. And my mother took me and about five of my friends to the theater to see it, and she was having kidney stones at the time. So she gets to sit through a two-hour movie.
Oh, man.
She probably doesn't understand or anything else, but it kind of taught me and kind of actually had some symmetry with the whole thing about Star Wars is sometimes sacrifices and pain have to be suffered to get to the goal in your life about people you care about. And I think that's kind of another underlying thing about Star Wars is all of the sacrifices that Luke and Leia and Han and everybody had to make, and even ultimately Vader had to make to be where they need to be.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. That's great.
Well, it's funny because Yoda has a great speech in Phantom Menace, you know, the most reviled Star Wars movie of all time, where he talks about the path to the dark side. Mm-hmm. And the first step is fear. And I remember using that with my son when he was about 6 years old. He was terrified of something and he was acting up about it. And I remember, you know, the Book of Yoda comes out. And I'm like, well, here are the thing. This is the way to the dark side. And the dark side is ultimately the way of panic and a lack of communication and frustration. We don't want to be that way. So it's kind of funny how you can use this this space opera to teach some rather important and impactful moral lessons in life.
It's a family film, certainly.
Definitely.
Yeah. We're here with Darrell Larson, a professor of theater and media arts at Brigham Young University. Lee George Cade is with us, panelist on the Geek Show podcast. We'll put a link to that on our website. And we'll take a break. Be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have Darryl Larson with us and Lee George Cape. We're talking about Star Wars. All right, let's talk about where this franchise, where this story is headed. Lee, you said that it's probably headed in the same direction as the Marvel films. Like there's a universe and there's a franchise idea and it's got a lot of a good future, I suppose.
There's definitely a template established there already. I mean, you look at everything that Kevin Feige has done with Marvel and making sure that there's an overarching unity between those things. You can look at also as kind of an idea of where things are going with Dave Filoni's group that's working on the Star Wars animated series Rebels right now. They did phenomenal work on the Clone Wars, which a lot of people saw in its first season and said, well, this is kind of silly. And by the time it gets to the third, fourth, fifth, sixth season, it's made the prequel series so much more coherent. It definitely filled in a lot of those blanks and made Anakin such so much more of a sympathetic character, kind of a terrifying character, but far more sympathetic. And so we're seeing a lot of that now with Rogue One. That's the movie that I think is going to make us go, oh, there is definitely a plan at work here, because we're going to see...
Now, Rogue One is the next...
That's next December Star Wars movie. And that's the part that makes my head swim. I mean, I'm closing in on 50. I saw the first one when I was 7, and I'm thinking that I may just be on my deathbed as the movies continue to come out, you know, as I...
But this is something, that, Darryl, you've talked about, because you said that Empire, which was the second one...
Right.
Was the really critical one. So for you, this next one in December is like this is the thing that's going to make it, because the first one is always about plots and establishing characters, and it's about exposition. We get that out of the way. We can really see if we can make this work on the second one. Is that what you're looking for here?
I'm still thinking that it's any major franchise, and if we're excited about it, it's the first film's going to be at least a safe triple, let's say. This one will be a home run, no problem. We'll be fine. Everybody's buying tickets for it. It's setting all sorts of records. It is that second film. It's how well the row is hoed by this particular film. And again, if I'm hearing complaints from the critics, it's that the film they're watching is too much like Star Wars. And I can think of an awful lot of people that I would talk to, friends of mine, younger and older, who would say, that's no problem at all. That is precisely what I want. I want it to be like Star Wars. So I think Abrams is probably purposely being as adhering as closely to the spirit of the original film as he possibly can, with that second film being the place where, like Empire did, maybe go a little darker, maybe a little more meditative, the adagio section of the work. And perhaps there we get a more important film, if you will, filmically, if we're talking about it critically. But as far – money-wise, I don't think this franchise has to worry about money. I'm not worried about George or Disney struggling after these films are released. The only challenge would be – and this goes into comes as we're talking about the Marvel Universe and other universes and Star Trek and other kinds of films – is the possibility of fan fatigue. At what point do fans begin to fall off and say, oh, there must be other things to watch, or I'm going to go home and watch Daredevil instead, or whatever it happens to be. There are so many of these films. In 1977, there was Star Wars.
Yeah. Familiarity breeds contempt. And
it can.
It can, but
I think
unless you do it right.
Right, and that's where two of my closest friends saw the movie on Tuesday, and they're as drunk as I've seen them without alcohol ever. So they're very, very happy with where the movie was, and it was ultimately because the heart was there. The heart of Star Wars was there. And if that's the one thing, I'm a big fan of the prequels. I will come right out and say it. But more from a technical standpoint, it's a very sterile setting. There's not a lot of heart or passion to it. I know some people would argue with me about that. But from what I'm hearing of Episode 7 is that the beating heart of Star Wars is alive and well in a very capably acted and directed movie. So, well,
Abrams, it seems, he killed it, I think, anyway, with Star Trek.
With the first one, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so he's been given this. I guess the question is, he takes the original conceit. He's got to be true to that for people to – right? I mean, he's got to take Lucas's vision.
Well, he's flat out said that's why he wanted to make movies in the first place,
exactly,
with Star Wars.
Yeah.
So it's kind of I imagine for him the most terrifying job in the world to pick up is, here's your biggest inspiration in life. Go make that movie.
You know what I love too is that he he, unlike the prequels, he doesn't want to rely on a lot of CGI stuff, a lot of green screen stuff. I mean, explosions that are real, people in actual costumes as opposed to computer generated stuff.
He's heard the fans. He is a fan.
Yeah, yeah.
And if there was a major complaint about the prequels, it's that those things are missing. It's the, you know, I even saw an early behind the scenes that Abrams was doing. And one of the things they did was to open up the film gate so that we could see film running through the gate. And the point was, we're shooting on film just the way they did for Star Wars, just the way they did for Empire Strikes Back. It's that purposeful connection to the fans, to the original film, to George's original intent, which I think a lot of fans felt like the prequel films got away from. They are gorgeous. The computer work there is stimulating.
Revolutionary.
And absolutely remarkable stuff. We tend to forget about some of the performances, and you know, the characters get lost in that world. And I don't think even in the middle of the Tatooine desert or with a Death Star exploding somewhere, we never did forget about the characters in the series we first watched, Star Wars and Empire and Jedi. And I think fans are looking forward to that in this next series.
What difference does it make if it's shot on film?
To most people,
not a difference.
None at all. To some of us that think we're smarter or we see better than other people, which we often don't, it's just nice to acknowledge the depth and the richness of the color that 35 or 65 millimeter film stock can create. Most people, honestly, will not recognize any difference, but I'm okay with a director like Abrams or Tarantino or others who are trying to embrace the films I grew up watching, and that's perfectly fine.
We're seeing this in the comic book industry right now. A lot of people in the comic book industry are working on Cintiq tablets. They're not actually drawing on paper anymore. And then you've got some of the old guards sitting down and saying, "No, I'm gonna keep doing paper, but I'm gonna scan it and color it digitally because that's easier." So ultimately, I think it comes down to what the artist decides they're gonna use at the end of the day. What is their toolbox filled with? What skill set are they bringing to the table? And is that something, if you get a Zack Snyder who does beautiful work on digital, some people would say it's almost too garish, it's too MTV, but the man really does beautiful digital work. And or Rian Johnson, who I think is going to turn around and his Star Wars movies will probably be mostly film, mostly old school effects, because that's what he's comfortable with. But the man can play in the digital sandbox pretty comfortably too.
When's the last time you guys saw the 77 first Star Wars? I say first, I shouldn't say first, it's fourth, right? The first film he made. When's the last time you guys saw it?
3 days ago.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's probably been
Why did you do that? Because you do it all the time? Or what?
Star Wars is one of those – it's holidays, right? So my wife wants to sit down and watch the Harry Potter movies, so we watch those, and then that leads right into Star Wars, and then the great debate between my son and I whether or not we need to stop between episode 2 and 3 to watch all of Clone Wars.
fill in the gaps.
Yeah, you got to fill in those gaps. And Ahsoka Tano really makes you sad, so you gotta get there. But we just watched a couple nights ago, and I'm not one of those purists that's going to turn back and say, "Oh, I need to see the original print," because I kind of respect some of the things he did. Kind of wish he hadn't in some areas. Like the Jabba the Hutt scene is largely superfluous, and they've changed it enough now that it doesn't look quite so garish. But still, a part of me wants to see the old movie again. But it's still a really neat movie.
But that's my question. If for a new generation encountering that film, does it still hold up? Does it work? I mean, because we're so used to technology in a different way, does it work?
It does work. It's great to contextualize it, though, before children or students watch it. We still use it in class. I have a 70s film class that I do every couple of years. And, you know, Star Wars and Close Encounters and those kinds of films are a part of that class. Initially, there is this sort of knee-jerk reaction to the first time the students watch a telephoto zoom.
Yeah.
The lens actually move in front of them. And it's discomforting to them. Halfway through the semester, they are having their epiphanies about the fact that lenses actually can refocus and move, and the crash zoom then that they see in a Quentin Tarantino film suddenly is revelatory. They think, wait a second, that's not brand new. That's borrowed from dozens of years before. So I think the context is probably important. It's like introducing anyone to something brand new that's old-fashioned, if you will, black and white film or whatever it happens to be. context works, but I think the film still stands up. It's still good, masterful storytelling, accessible, easily described to someone else. What's it about? Mm-hmm. You can tell them what it's about. So it's still a remarkable film after all these years.
Well, the funny part is it has aged very, very well. But a good story that's told with good expression, a good expressor of film or a good storyteller can tell a universal story. I remember showing my kids Larry Buster Crab, Flash Gordon serials on YouTube 10 years ago, and they were completely mesmerized by it because no matter how schlocky it was, no matter how ridiculous the clay men that were coming out of the walls looked, that Ming the Merciless was amazing. The set design was phenomenal, and watching the little bottle ship as it came and circled down onto the planet's surface. And then the same exact epiphany for my son when he was about 11, realizing, oh my gosh, they did that, you know, on a tiny little miniature with strings and fishing wire, and that was probably a sparkler and a smoke bomb in the tail end of the thing. And that is so quintessential. So even if Star Wars does start to age, even if it does start to show its patina a little bit, I think it's going to continue to be an important dialogue for us when we talk about film or when we talk about culture or mythology or those things that tie us together instead of breaking us apart.
You'd all worried that your expectations might be a little too high.
Well, we call that a Phantom Menace syndrome because I think despite what that movie had going wrong with it, people had already built their prequel movie before they saw it. And so when they saw a different movie on the screen, so we maybe have learned that lesson as we go into episode 7, that our expectations are not what we're going to see. We're going to see something else. But in the meantime, stop flying drones over the studio walls. I kind of want to have a fresh experience with this movie.
I'm going to see it as a film professor, but also as a film fan. So I'll be 52 and 13, I suppose, at the same time.
Yeah.
And so I don't think I can't be excited about it. It will pay off for me. Yeah.
It's Tara Larson, professor of theater and media arts at Brigham Young University. Lee George Cade, panelist on the Geek Show podcast. Thank you both very much.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thanks.
I can't wait either. Technical direction today from Tim Slover. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Josh Weathers is producer for Video West, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Andy Lane Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.